tonight, guys, we have two great guests, husband and wife, Gavin and Paula. Gavin Griffith was diagnosed with type 1 when he was only 8 years old in 2000. He's still only a baby chicken. Paula's a pediatric diabetes dietitian and was diagnosed with type 1 when she was 4 years old. Gavin is a fantastic diabetes advocate, and it all started with his blogs, marathon running, and spectacular events, including his mammoth challenges that he has just mentioned. Gavin set up Diathlete in 2015, and tonight we'll hear about the amazing charity and some of the things that they do, including workshops and diabetes camps, and a new thing about that's, I don't think I've ever heard of it from anybody before, except from you guys, like earlier on this year, is the Type 1 Festival. Welcome, Gavin and Paula, to Diabetes Chat. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Mary.
Go ahead there, Tom.
Is it me on this section? Yeah. So thank
you're
Mary.
You're in this section, yeah.
Let's crack on, because there's so much to cover. So we're going to do is a quick sort of quick fire round questions. It usually takes about 5 minutes. And because both of you, so your husband and wife, and you've both got diabetes, as Mary mentioned, Gavin, when you were 8, and Paul, you were diagnosed when you were 4. So we can both sort of answer these questions, but it's sort of quick fire questions, like things that come to your mind quickly rather than a long sort of answer. And then later on, we'll basically go into more detail. Does that sound good?
Yeah, but she's a lot quicker than me.
Why don't Paul answer first, and then you can have some time and then answer next, yeah? Let's go for it.
Okay.
So let's go. What is your name and occupation?
Paula, dietitian.
Gavin, I'm a project manager.
When were you diagnosed with diabetes, and how old were you?
1999, I was 4.
I was 8, January 2000.
Do you finger prick or use smart technology like Flash or CGM?
CGM.
CGM now as well.
When you finger pricked, did you change the lancet every day?
Never.
Never.
Do you use insulin pens or pump, and what do you prefer?
Insulin pump.
I'm a pampered now too, but I don't know if what I prefer, but I'm going to go with pump.
Are you hyper-aware?
Yes.
So-so. I'm okay, but yeah, not great.
What symptoms do you have of hypoglycemia?
I sweat my hands, yep. And I get very slow.
Paula telling me off.
Why'd you go to hypo treatments?
Jelly babies.
Oh, that's good when you do the big shop, isn't it? Like, if you're both into jelly babies, it's not like you're getting several different items.
They're cheaper.
Yeah. Buy one, get one free. There you go, guys. What do you think's worse for you guys? Feeling hypo or feeling hyper?
Hypo.
Hyper.
Ooh. One thing you like about diabetes and one thing you don't like about diabetes.
I like feeling empathic with others living with diabetes, and I don't like hypers.
I suppose I have to say my wife. And yeah, and I don't know about my don't likes. I think I've got over them, so I don't have a quick answer for you.
No worries. And do you like the smell of insulin, or are you not bothered?
Not bothered.
No.
And final question, if you're on a diabetes chat desert island, what three things would you take? And you've got all your diabetes kit there, so your pumps and your CGM and your jelly babies, guys. You buy one, get one free jelly babies. What other things would you take, just to get to know you a little bit?
Oh my God.
hardest question, right?
iced tea.
Iced tea.
Can I just say one?
One's fine.
Pen and paper, rum, and probably something that I can float off that island with. I don't know.
Brilliant. Well done, guys. That was amazing just to get to know you a bit and a bit of fun. Hey, Mary, that's good, eh?
That was fab. That was so cool.
Oh, super cool. Super cool. Quick fire questions, quick fire answers. Love it. All right. So let's get to know you a little bit more. And Mary, please, if there's any time that you want to extend on any of the comments from the questions or anything, just throw it in and we'll wing it together. Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. So obviously you both diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and I'll ask the questions and they'll be hopefully relevant to you both, and feel free to chip in whoever wants to go first and chip in from each other's comments sort of thing if you want to. So obviously, you were very young when you were both diagnosed, Gavin 8 and Paula 4. What sort of symptoms did you guys have when you were diagnosed with diabetes, and how were you sort of feeling at that time? Did you sort of know any of it? Obviously, Paul, you were very young at 4, Gavin 8, so you're still very young as a child, but did you remember anything from these times, or was there any sort of experiences like your parents have shared with you or people have shared with you?
So in my case, I got like all the usual symptoms, like losing weight and peeing the bed. One of the things that I can remember is I have some flashbacks of the hospital and some parts of the hospital and the smell of the hospital. And I remember, just like the feeling in there. And then I remember that one of the doctors gave me like a cube to play. And that doctor, I ended up working with him as a dietitian, I don't know, 15 years later.
Wow.
So, yeah.
But like a Rubik's Cube, Paula?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he gave it to me. He was just graduated from to be a doctor, and he was learning about diabetes, and he was, when I was there, and now I worked with him.
Random thing to give you.
Yeah.
But it's good that you have a sort of memorable moment, like, you know what I mean? Four years old, it's very, very young. And if I ask my son, like, to be honest, my son's got really good long-term memory, but if I say short-term things, he completely forgets, bless him. But yeah, it's really interesting. Can I go on, Mary.
Can I put in, how did you remember him, Paula?
No, I remember the cube, but I don't remember his face.
Yeah.
And same thing. It's like how it felt. I feel like at that age, maybe you remember more like how you felt or how it was the smell. It's just I remember that he gave me the cube, and I kept my cube, and I still have it.
And how did you work out that he was the one who gave it to you when you were working with him? How did that, because he was just always there still, or?
Oh yeah, he always stayed in the same hospital.
Right.
He ended up being the main doctor.
Right, yeah, okay, yeah. Get it. Sorry for putting it.
All good. What about you then, Gavin? What sort of symptoms did you have when you, obviously were diagnosed, you were 8 years old, so any sort of more memories of that time, I guess, maybe?
Yeah, a lot. To be honest, I remember a lot of it very clear, which probably seems to have done there. I don't remember where I put my phone, where my wallet is, where my keys are, what happened 2 weeks ago, what Paola just said at dinner. But I do remember very, very clearly things from the past. And I think particularly when it comes to something like diabetes, you know, even as Paola said, you know, there's little things that will stand out to you. I think most people probably remember the name of the doctor, Dr. Hood. He was retiring. I was his last type 1 patient. Things like that, I remember with quite a bit of detail. For me, it was Christmas 1999, where I just before the school holidays, where I become unwell. Wow. And I was off school, and we didn't, at that time, the symptoms weren't there. It was this millennium bug, as they were calling it, at the time, was going around. They were talking about the world ending and this computer virus going about, and everybody got a flu virus around the same time, and I caught that in school. And I remember that very, very well, that those symptoms. I never went to school 2 weeks before the Christmas holidays, and then in the Christmas holidays, my symptoms changed to obviously needing to go to the toilet all the time, being so thirsty, those typical symptoms. And I got diagnosed. I couldn't get a doctor's appointment because it was so busy at that time of year, Christmas and all that, that it was the 7th of January that was my diagnosis. So it took a long time. It was very.
So you're talking like middle of December, really, when you potentially shown these signs of diabetes, which you weren't really know of because you may be thinking of flu and things like that. And then obviously Christmas come and then got worse and worse. And then, like, say, the busyness of getting an appointment. And then, it's like potentially a month of you developing the diabetes and getting iller and iller, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say the whole thing was probably good at least a month. And then obviously not knowing that my insulin's not being produced anymore or not as much, and quickly running out. Christmas puds probably weren't too welcome at the time, but I didn't know much about that. And it was a very late diagnosis. And
Do
you remember how you felt over Christmas? Like did your mom and dad remember like you feeling funny or sleepy or?
Yeah, I think it was a range of emotions, really. I was very poorly. I was losing weight quite significantly. And, you know, we didn't know anything about diabetes at the time whatsoever. We never imagined it would be diabetes. And I remember one night I just started crying. And you know, I kind of knew something was about to change my life without knowing what, but was unable to sleep. And that was around a Christmas or Boxing Day or something like that.
Aww.
And, you know, there's no reason for me to be upset at that moment. But, yeah, I remember that always stuck with me. It's like I kind of, my body almost knew something and it was trying to tell me almost.
Wow. And how long did you guys spend in hospital and when you were diagnosed? Do you know?
So I was diagnosed in Costa Rica. And I spent, I think, maybe a couple of weeks. Yeah, so you get to get the visit from, it's same as here, like a diabetes nurse, psychologist, everyone. And they do ask for another families to come and say hello.
Yeah.
So that was very good. Families that have children with diabetes, so you get like one family to visit you and they kind of share their experiences and stuff. So I think that was really good from my diagnosis and from my family.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine.
I was there for a week.
And was your time in the hospital, you said a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, was that because of the severity of how ill you were, or is that the common practice of how long someone would maybe stay in hospital at that time or now? Or I'm just curious to see if there's any more to that with where you were diagnosed in Costa Rica.
Yeah, it was all about mainly the education, because luckily I wasn't in DKA or anything. My parents were able to detect the symptoms really early, so I was never like really poorly. It was more about the education, like getting everything in. There wasn't carb count at that time. It was more like a strict diet that you needed to follow. So you needed to get very good at that. And until everyone was convinced that you could cope well with injections and everything else. And it was syringes. It wasn't insulin pens.
Yes.
And it was like a little test strip where you needed to put your blood and the color changed. Mm-hmm. And it was in between, I don't know, it's between 5 and 8. The color is light green and things like that. So it was really old.
I'm definitely really appreciative that they obviously went into a lot of detail and gave you that education to it, rather than hey, there you go. So it's really interesting to hear that. What about you then, Gavin? When you were first diagnosed, what sort of things were you administered with? Were you using syringes as well or pens?
I was also on syringes for the first couple of years, and then went on to pens. I used to have 3 pens a day. I remember that. And that was kind of like a mixed insulin that I was on. So I just named them like the green one, the orange one, the blue one. I never actually come to terms with what the, you know, the high level. I think that's one of the parts. That's why we have this charity almost is because it's very clinical, this condition.
Yeah.
And you need to break that down into, you're the one that manages it. You're the one that's got to deal with that every day. So it needs to relate better to you, the education that comes with it. And that doesn't always happen. I don't think it happened back then because we had no clue what diabetes was.
Yep.
And obviously now, in a good way, you could say, but still there's much more out there. It's much more technical now. It's much more information now almost. And I think that perhaps is even harder for particularly young people and families dealing with it.
True.
To adjust to.
No.
It's overwhelming.
Yeah, 100%. And then I guess over the years, you guys have used different sort of techniques to, like you say, monitor your blood levels, and now using CGM. And how does the CGM impact your sort of life now? Like, if you look back now to go, wow, like all them years ago, I was, say, finger pricking or using other ways, but now using technology like CGM, how has that changed your life?
I think I would say 90% is positive, because of course you have more awareness of what's going on, and I feel like you can perform better when you do sports and when you're driving and when you're working.
Yeah,
it's so like it gives you that peace of mind that you know where you are, but sometimes it's like you know too much and it can be overwhelming. So yes. I think in the past, when I used to use finger pricks, I used to maybe finger prick maybe 5 times a day or 6 times a day. But that time that you weren't finger pricking, you weren't thinking as much about your diabetes, and that Absolutely. Was like a relaxing piece. But now you always have it like in your watch, in your phone, in your pump. Yeah. So many numbers.
I can totally relate to that, and I totally respect and get that, absolutely, because mm-hmm. like you say, now how much the technology is great, but it's always there with us, isn't it? Like you say, on smartphones, on watches, everywhere, and you can see it quickly, like you turn on your phone and it's there, and 10 years ago, whatever, you would have, like you say, finger prick for the set times, and yeah, it's different, but like you say, there's a lot of impacts, a lot of positive impacts of it as well. Like you said, the exercise and driving and sports and things like that. What about you, Gavin? How has CGM helped you? As I guess with exercise and stuff, it's had a big impact, right?
Yeah, I'd say. I mean, I'm not as active as I was doing the crazy things I was doing 4 or 5 years ago. So in many ways, my lifestyle changed. Obviously, it did for everybody with COVID. And that's when I went on to being on a pump and CGM. And I kind of made that decision thinking more about my long term.
Yes,
I was seeing the higher blood sugar levels quite often. And I felt like it was time for me to now make a change. So I had to make a decision that I hadn't made before in terms of that transition. And it is a change for the better. There's no question about that. As Paul said, it is much more visual. You know, it's there every day, and I think that's probably more of a challenge perhaps for parents, seeing a slight higher, a slight low, that brings even more anxiety and panic. So I think that's where perhaps the challenge is it's seeing it more frequently. It's perhaps so, particularly for younger people and their parents, that relationship maybe, because I used to get angry when my mum would say, "What's your blood?" every 5 minutes. Absolutely. You know, when I got home from school or something like that. So you can only imagine, mum can see it all the time now. I can't lie about it. I can't say I'm fine, go away.
Oh my God, that would be dreadful.
So yeah, yes. So you know, there's that going on. So yeah, I would say though, at the time, that I just kind of add to that would be, it is, you know, as I say, that might be an issue, but that's a small issue compared to everything else. That is, it's a great thing for your long-term health. And when you consider, this is what probably does need to be addressed, is the gaps that are opening up in the world. We're talking about this in the UK, and we're growing in the UK in a good way. I'd say it's taken a bit of time. These things have been out there for a while, but now we're starting to get more and more access, not pediatrics, but perhaps adults getting there soon enough, but not quite there. But when you go overseas, a lot of people are still using what Powell and I have said we were using 20 years ago.
Absolutely.
That is still happening. So we need, I think more awareness needs to be raised about that.
I think also a following point as well is, you talked about education, and that's what you guys are really strong for, and the charity and stuff. And I think we just need to continue pushing education and providing people the training and the support. And for instance, the technology and the data and stuff like that, I guess from my point I'm speaking, is it can be very overwhelming. Sometimes you may not know exactly the ins and outs of it, and maybe seeing that data all the time can be very overwhelming, isn't it? Because you may not really understand it. And like you said, Gavin, it's your diabetes, it's your life, and we need to understand it as best as we can, and having amazing people like yourselves breaking it down and sharing your knowledge and experiences is very helpful to people.
Yeah, I think there's a psychological aspect to it as well. Like I it is what you prefer, but sometimes you've got to look at what you think is actually best. For me, for a long time, I started seeing those high blood sugars much more than I was seeing perhaps even in range. And I was quite proud before that of how I used to manage my diabetes. I think CGMs are a big advantage to whatever you're using. But I was quite proud of my way of going with multiple daily injections. I was comfortable in that for a long time. But when my lifestyle changed a bit, new work, being at home a lot more with COVID, that's when I kind of decided for myself, okay, I'm going to try something a bit different. And I think in my head, I'd said, I'm not a techie person. I told myself these things, like, mm-hmm. I'm not, if I tell myself that, then I'm not going to give these things a go. So it is about kind of shaping your own thoughts about how you see yourself when it comes to making these changes, particularly in how you manage your diabetes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anything we do, isn't it? It that translates to everything. If we put the words in our heads, then
yeah. I mean, that's how I run those marathons. An arrogant teenager or a young adult that said, you know what, I can do anything.
Yeah,
and just as a result, I did.
Just proven that there's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah,
To the nth degree.
Maybe it's damaging a little bit, but
yeah.
Was there any other questions you wanted to ask in that section? I think it's a great section to get us started, Mary. Is there anything else, or shall we move to our next one with you?
No. I think I love the hospital ones and like the duration of stays and like
really interesting,
those memories.
It? Yeah,
I love those stories because we
and it varies when we've had different people on, whether people guest speakers or people in the community coming on to chat on the open forum. People have different experiences. It's your diabetes, and that's what our community is, diabetes chat, talking about diabetes. And some people come on and say they're in hospital for a couple of days, like a day or two, like a week. Mm. And it's interesting to see, like Paula's saying, weeks, like 3 weeks. It's and different areas, different places, different situations. And what I really liked about Paula's wasn't necessarily about, say, the severity of how she was ill or anything, but I loved how it was talking about the knowledge. When you're leaving at this hospital, you're going when you're as maximum as you can with the knowledge and insights, and you're going away with that toolkit, with that education toolkit, to go, okay, I get it. You know what I mean? And I'm sure Paula's mum and dad and whoever would have come away, and there still would have been thousands of questions and situations. Yeah. But it's just interesting, Mary, isn't it? Like each person's care, and it varies.
And like in Costa Rica, I'm like thinking time frame too. Like I was diagnosed in 97 and I got pens, Paula, and I had a glucometer that mm-hmm. and like that was 2 years before you, but then I'm also thinking I didn't get a family coming in to talk to me, so mm-hmm. They already knew the important things, like like knowledge and support from people who spoke your language, like your own, not
medical
language.
It goes a long way,
language.
Doesn't it? It goes a long way.
Yeah. And I'm it is everybody's story is fascinating, but it's like we all try and relate it with ourselves, like and where we are, and like I think of Johnny, like Gavin, when your story, because Johnny was six and being diagnosed as a young boy, and like there's lots of things you can put your story.
Maybe before we go to the next section, what was like? You both very young, Paula 4, Gav 8. What was it like growing up with having diabetes? Very, very young people, and obviously going into the teenage years and stuff. How was like living with diabetes? How did you feel about it? Like, did things change over the years going into the teenage years? How was it?
Great question.
Socially, how did you talk about it, or did you find it quite hard? I found it really hard, but I'm just interested in how did your childhood sort of evolve with having this element? There's more to you, and you're amazing people.
How did it feel?
But yeah, how did it feel?
So in my case, I think at the beginning it was mainly my parents taking full control of everything, and I think they were the ones feeling so many stuff and feeling so worried about everything because I was the only one living with diabetes in my family. But then of the things that I can remember, my mom, like the year after I was diagnosed, my dad lost his job. So they were like, okay, how do we make this like super bad thing that happened, like this condition, as an opportunity? And my mom started to kind of do sugar-free cakes for other families because, at the moment, there wasn't any carb counting. There was just like eating healthy, not eating sugar at all. So those things that happened, they took them as opportunities. And I feel like I grew up with that kind of mindset of,
Yeah.
Okay, you have diabetes, but how can you use this to do something good?
Yeah.
And I think at the beginning, my childhood, it was a little bit like that. And so diabetes wasn't like a bad thing at home. But when I was in high school, I decided not to tell to tell anybody about it. I was super shy. I started like a new course or something like that, a new year, I didn't want my mom to go and tell my teachers I have diabetes because I didn't want to be different. Yeah. And in fact, one time, one of my teachers, when I was it's different in Costa Rica, but I was maybe 10 or 9. And I was having like a sugar-free biscuit, like a chocolate biscuit. And she made me throw up the biscuit because the teacher thought that because it had sugar, it would kill me because I had diabetes.
Wow.
So it was like really bad. Yeah. So a lot of those type of things happen when there's like not enough information about diabetes.
Sure,
so
sure.
I think that made my high school to be like diabetes was like another identity I had, and with the charity and everything like that that my mom did. I feel like I had two. There were two Paulas, the one with diabetes and the other one without diabetes.
No, I can relate to that.
Oh my gosh. So can I, Mary. Like, when you say that, yeah. It's like, oh my God, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
What about you, Gavin, growing up with diabetes, obviously 8 years old and then going into like sort of teenagers, young adults, like how did you sort of cope or manage with this life condition?
Yeah, it was a difficult time in spells. You know, I had a very good childhood. I would say that, you know, I had a very supportive, loving family. I think that's every ingredient that you need in life is that. And you see that at its utmost, perhaps in those negative experiences like getting diagnosed with diabetes. So I was very blessed there. But I had an impact. I think from day one in the hospital, almost coming out, my first question to the doctor was, can I still play sports? Can I still play football? That's what I love doing. And it wasn't encouraged. You know, it was more, again, very high level clinical talks telling me about risks. This could happen. Worst case, hypoglycemia, leads to a coma. And these are things that an 8 year old is not going to take in very well. I think what particularly young people need is encouragement with the information around diabetes. And that seemed to lack in my experience initially. And that meant that even though I had a very good actually pediatric diabetes team in the end, a few new people came to, great nurses that I had, I remember at my hospital. I had that negative that attitude in the background because my first doctor, who was actually retiring at the time, that probably learned about diabetes in the 60s or 70s, completely changed obviously the time I got diagnosed, saw a different view and gave it and maybe didn't present it in the right way. And it shows you how language can have a bit of an impact. And I probably rebelled more as a reason for.
And it's interesting, isn't it, guys? We're talking like these times of the last 20 years ago and these sort of matters still, I guess, happening right now, isn't it? Language matters. It's very, very important. Mm-hmm. And the stigmas of diabetes, two massive talking points right now. And it's interesting that we're still having these discussions maybe 20 years on.
Do you know what? I'm just thinking about what Paula said about like being two Paulas and like healthcare treat us like we're like the medical version of ourselves and forget like we're with the other part of us that is not diabetes.
Yeah.
So
totally.
But that part wants to go play football.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's once I started getting out there and doing that for myself and realizing, you know, there were obviously lessons to be learned, but realizing I could do those things that kind of helped in time give me confidence to manage and become independent, if you like, with the diabetes. The more times I did the things I wanted to do and enjoyed doing the most, you know, I had to, football was a big lesson for me with diabetes. I was always told about watch out for the low blood sugars. And actually, particularly as I got into those teenage years, my body started changing. I found I was getting more high blood sugars and I was crashing blood after. So I only learned that through loving the sport and being so that love of the sport, willing to test my blood sugars, take on those responsibilities a little bit more than my everyday, which gave me the best lessons for life. But yeah, I think outside of that, I probably struggled in those tween, if you like, those in-between years coming into a teenager and those early and transitioning into school. That was where I felt a little bit more kind of outside everybody else, treated a bit differently, if you like, in school. And that was probably one of the more difficult things to come to terms with and to find myself and grow that confidence that I mentioned. But the more I did the things that I enjoyed, in time I did find myself and I did find that I can manage this and I can live my life.
Absolutely.
What way were your parents, both of you, what way were your parents when like you were in like kind of like second level education and trying to find your way, like you're not wanting your mom to go and tell your teachers or your course who like but you've got diabetes, Paula, and but what way were your parents supporting you? Because like they didn't have the visuals on your type one that like I have for Johnny. So do you ever talk to your parents about what they felt like about helping you?
So my mom, as I said, like she was like very much like, okay, what can we do about this? And apart from the sugar-free cakes and business that they still have now, she created a charity for children with diabetes in Costa Rica, the only one for children. And he's still alive. So I think throughout my whole high school, it was also, as I was saying, like there was like two identities also in the way that we used to get called by the TV and newspaper just to share our story and how we deal with diabetes every day. So my mom was like always listening to others' families and supporting other families. So she was like a really good listener and she was like really, really supportive. But my dad was always like on the background. And he was, mm-hmm. I think how he dealt with diabetes was in a different way than my mom. My mom was like, we need to do something about this. And my dad, I think he still, when he talks about my diagnosis, he cries.
Aww.
So he was very supportive, but he was very kind of like quiet and on the background, but still supportive. I don't know.
I understand.
So yeah, it was very different how moms and dads deal with the diagnosis.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Gavin, what about you?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think, yeah, my mom and dad, I mean, if I asked them about certain things, certain terminologies about diabetes today, even basal bolus insulin, they wouldn't have a clue what I'm talking about. But but I think they support me the best they could through encouragement, through love, I'd say. And that's the same ingredient back then that is as relevant today, and it always will be, because without that support in the background, that's where diabetes comes a lot harder. Sure, there was areas of knowledge that we didn't know at the time, we weren't taught at the time, wasn't so much out there. But yeah, I think that they always did, you know, as I say, when I got back into football, they were the ones encouraged me. My dad was at every single game I ever played as a child, you know, and always supported me on the line and never fear of something wrong going on.
It's them underpinning foundations, isn't it? The care and support and having people who will do anything and everything possible for you, and they will always do their best, and by the sounds that they did, and it's great how supportive they are.
I'm just wondering if, because of the lack of technology back when you guys were small, do you think your parents have the same fear as parents now when they can see things?
Probably not in terms of that. I mean, they've learned over the years. Now we're adults. We know that we're grown up and left.
I know you're okay now, but I mean, when you were smaller.
I would say they would absolutely the same as any parent today. You know, look at the amount of times that I'd be curious, what's the blood sugar? What's the blood sugar? Are you high? Are you low? Yeah. If I did something wrong, you better be low. So it was kind of, you know, that was kind of the language I used to get quite a bit.
So funny.
I guess that worry was there, but they weren't able to check on it. So, of course,
it
would be the same.
It was easier to lie on your numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's brilliant. That's funny. That was funny. All right, How are we doing, Tom?
No, we're doing good. Really interesting to hear two amazing perspectives, husband and wife. I just think it's ace. It's just great that you both are living with diabetes, and I'm sure supporting each other through the highs and lows, literally. And it's great. I think you're our first ever husband and wife couple as a guest speaker. So, fantastic. All right, so let's go to Mary, and she's got a section now that she's gonna get to know Paul a little bit, talking about your background as a dietitian, and then Gavin, we're gonna talk a little bit about exercise, and oh, there's a big daddy long legs there about to crawl over me. No. You tell we're live. And then we're gonna talk about exercise and the marathons and all the fantastic things that you did. And then we'll talk about the charity and why you set it up, and the sort of things that you do in terms of like the workshops and the events and the camp that you did in the summer and the upcoming Type 1 festival, which sounds absolutely amazing. So you guys can tell Mary all about it, give us loads of plugs, and share everything. So over back to you, Mary.
Yeah. Go. Cool. So Paola, I didn't realize that your background, your family's background in diabetes too. So can you tell us a little bit more about how you ended up as a dietitian? I find it even more fascinating now, because not that you have type 1 and you're a dietitian, but you grew up with diabetes in your body, all around you, in your family business and the charity, and yet you still surround yourself in diabetes that's not your diabetes as well in your adult life. Tell us a bit about that journey.
Yeah, so well, because of my charity, one of the things I realized with the families is that one of their main concerns was to give insulin and deal with injections all day, every day. It was more the diet and all the myths that exist around diabetes and food, and all the stress that brings to the families, because of course food is also a social thing. It's not just about getting nutrition from the food, but it's also something that you enjoy and you go out and with people. And a lot of the families came really, really sad, with some dietitians telling them that they needed to stop eating pizza and they could not go out again with their friends because they couldn't eat that because they have diabetes. So I decided to be a dietitian because I thought I really love sciences, and I was a geek in sciences, and and I used to love how the human body works and everything. So yeah, I decided to be a dietitian, and I certified myself as a diabetes educator. But you said something really important about being surrounded with diabetes, and it also requires a lot of being intentional to take your own time outside diabetes.
Yeah.
Because you can get crazy and you can get burnout. And I think about maybe 2 years ago, before I came to the UK, I used to kind of have my Instagram profile and blog a lot about it. And I got really burnout. And sometimes I still try to kind of assess myself in the way of should I join this or not? Because am I a bit tired of diabetes at this point or not? And then making decisions around how I feel, because I'm really passionate about talking about diabetes and helping other people, but also you need to think about yourself and how you feel. So yeah, it's quite a challenging thing, but I think it's really then the reward of really impacting people and bringing hope is priceless.
Yeah I was gonna ask you what really fascinates you about diabetes, but you probably answered that quite well there too, that it's in the food. But is there something else that does that with diabetes in you as well, because you are so surrounded by it? So what is it that drives you with diabetes?
I think that's a good question. I think it's interesting in terms of as a healthcare professional, there's so many ways that you can learn and do, and there's so many things that you can do about diabetes. You can think about technology, you can think about food, emotional health, so many areas to it.
Connected to so many things.
Exactly, to everything, basically. So I think it's entertaining in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if entertaining is the right word to describe diabetes.
In this room, it totally is.
It is.
Like, nobody's eyes going to glaze over. Oh, you're talking about diabetes again.
On the flip side, is it sometimes maybe challenging that there's potentially no escape to it? If it's part of your life, with you having type 1, your partner, your husband Gavin having type 1, your connection with your background, with your family, like you said, and then with your career, if there's a jigsaw puzzle, there's a lot of connections to it. Can that be a challenge at times, or do you overcome this in other ways?
Yeah, I mean, the other day it was really, really weird because we borrow a dog. It sounds weird, but it's this thing called Borrow My Dog, and we borrow a dog. It was a Labradoodle, and the owner was like, oh, he has diabetes. He has diabetes, and you need to give him insulin for dinner. And we were like, oh, no. It's really happening. Like, he's just following us everywhere.
You borrow a dog and you borrow a type 1 dog.
Yeah, it's just
a dog with diabetes.
Yeah, we really didn't know about it. So I think we've got to that point of like, okay, whenever we feel like overwhelmed or like burnout, we're like, this is actually our purpose. Like, getting to that point of like, this is our purpose, and we feel that we're good at it, and we've done good stuff about it and cool stuff about it. So yeah, it is challenging. There are some days that I just want to stop doing anything related to diabetes. But other days, like today, I'm talking about this. It's like real fun. So
I know. You try and do something that doesn't have diabetes in it, and you find a diabetic dog.
Exactly.
That is incredible. Like, the odds of that. It's like winning the Euro Millions, right? Incredible.
I know.
Yeah. You know, we're not going to win that.
Right. I'm going to ask you about your work, Paula, as well. Can you give us through our eyes, like, what's your day to day life look like in work?
Yeah. So as a pediatric diabetes dietitian, is kind of a cool job because you can get involved in different areas. So we have clinics where you need to work with other healthcare professionals like psychologists, diabetes nurses, doctors. So let's say a day like today, I saw maybe 15 or 16 families living with diabetes. So we would like, it's really cool because sometimes if they're using my same insulin pump, I can be like, hey, we have the same insulin pump, and they feel like there's someone in the room that understands them.
Absolutely.
Or I can show my sensor and they're like, oh, I also have a sensor. And so it's really, really nice in that way. And you can give advice in terms of how food affects your spikes and different things. There are also like dietetic clinics where I see the families and we talk about sports, we talk about food. There's also a factor of like developing resources, doing research. So yeah, it's quite like a dynamic work. And yeah, that's in a summary.
What's your favorite bit about it?
I think those moments when, like, let's say a day like today, there was a two-year-old that you sometimes think, oh, he's not going to react to this. And I was like, and he was wearing a freestyle. And I saw that in he was very shy in the clinic. And he was, like, hiding behind a chair. So I saw that he was wearing a freestyle. So I came, like, closer to him and I showed him my arm.
Yeah.
And that made him get out of the chair, like, go in front of their seat and be a little bit more interactive with the rest of the team.
Yeah.
So moments like today, makes the work much nicer.
Worthwhile, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. What do you find hard? What's challenging?
Oh, that thing of talking about diabetes every day.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think that's the challenging bit. And of course, sometimes I feel really sad about some of the young people or the families when they really don't want to put their insulin or follow their advice or take care of themselves, because you know how it feels, you know how they're feeling. You feel like a bit scared about seeing complications in other people and stuff, like you think about yourself. So I think that's the most challenging.
Last question as well, of you're working in diabetes, you have type 1, sometimes everything's fine till it's not fine, and sometimes there are like a bad run of days and nights.
Yeah.
And you still turn up for work.
Yeah.
And then somebody doesn't turn up for work and they haven't had the week you've had. Like, how do you deal with those kind of things? Like, type 1 makes us, like, I don't know, superhuman sometimes. And yeah, or maybe just don't want it. Like, I'm alive, I can go to work.
Yeah.
how do you give your type 1, how do you give your diabetes space that others can give with their well-being in their work, because work in diabetes?
I think I would be cheating a bit here, because my colleagues, they all work in diabetes. So sometimes I get to work and I'm like, oh, I don't know, I had a weird morning, I had a hyper, I didn't feel good. And they're like, oh, don't worry, just sit there. We managed the clinic this morning.
That's lovely.
Yeah, so they're they really understand what I'm going through. So I think, yeah, I don't feel
That's great.
I'm not understood, or I need to push myself into it. Or sometimes, I now rarely have bad days with my diabetes since I started on closed loop. I think like the nights are amazing. Sometimes I don't know, it could be that happens, but they will be very, very like nice with me
in that. It's just really when a sensor dies or at the wrong time, and then everything just goes skewball. Yeah, all right, I've loved talking to you about that. Gavin, we're going to talk about exercise, because that's your that's what I know about you. I want you to talk about like the determination that you have to just do it, like the 25 marathons in a month and then the 30 marathons in a month. What got you started running and competing in marathons, and like, why?
And I think I got hit on the head when I was in hospital. I think initially, it came out in the right and wrong reasons to begin with, in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, in school, that was probably a difficult time. And that's when I had like a chip on my shoulder, if you like, because of the lack of information about exercise, the lack of encouragement around it at the time. So I think that's where I had like a big passion to go and do something. And I actually ran my first marathon distance or challenge when I was 17. I was too young to register for the London Marathon, so I ran 29 miles. I ran the Thanet Coast. I was like that. I had that point to prove. Like, okay, I can't run 26, I'll do 29. And and I had that kind of attitude, which is good, but it's also, it's not wrong, but I feel like initially it was like me against the world, and that's why I wanted to do it. You know, that's why I wanted to take on the extreme challenges. I wanted to prove something to myself, I guess, with the diabetes, and that, you know, this wasn't going to stop me, which sounds good on paper, but I think actually now I'm probably more level-headed, I hope so anyway. And, you know, diabetes is what it is. It's not different from me. I haven't got proven against it because it's part of me. It's 2% of my pancreas. It doesn't work. It's not, you know, be all and end all as such. And I think I saw diabetes when I was younger almost as a different person that I needed to take on as a competitor. And that's what kind of was my...
That's interesting. Problem. That's such an interesting perspective on it. Like, because diabetes can feel like it takes over our whole lives, but like putting into that perspective is really nice.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's part. It's, you know, that's acceptance, I guess, in some ways. But easy, but it's a big step. And yeah, I think I saw that probably more that way when I started running the crazy challenges. I was doing 30-30. I was doing it. That was 2013. That was 10 years ago. It's crazy. But I was running from John O'Groats to Land's End. And I decided to do that big challenge because I had that chip on the shoulder, because I tried and tried again to fundraise and things like that and never seemed to quite achieve it. And yeah, just wanted to do more. I think I had that challenge bug in me. So I was out there doing that. I decided, and it took a long time to train and to
how just, did you train? How did you train?
I had a lot of confidence, and I think that fits into what I said earlier in all things. Like, it's how you see yourself that really goes one way or another, and the best times it goes the other, right? It's trying to, I'm a bit like that at the moment. I'm trying to get myself into a better routine. Now I'm working from home still since COVID and things like that, and I'm living a different way. So I think it's how you see it that makes a big long-term impact. And there's something true in that than how you see diabetes, which, you know, the slightest low blood sugar or whatever can just throw your confidence.
Yeah. And is it you don't know that you can do it, but you know, or you don't know you'll definitely do it, but you know that you can. I remember reading something like, don't tell me I can't do it. Tell me it's possible. And then you just try.
Yeah. I'd say, like, I've done those challenges. I've done big challenges. And in my head, I knew that I wasn't going to fail. As bizarre as it sounds, to go from John O'Groats to Land's End and run, it was 30-mile routes every day for 30 days is basically what I'd mapped out.
Did you think you definitely could do it?
I think that's why I did, is almost that I was sure I could do it.
Wow.
And it's a hard thing. You know, the hardest thing isn't running. It's getting up the next day after running and trying to go and getting your body to go. But I think I learned something from that challenge, and that was probably the big transition into my life, is the transition where perhaps this charity then become a charity, or the idea for a charity to come from, was in doing it. Firstly, I saw how incredible the body is. I mean, 2% of the pancreas doesn't work, and we're trying to make all these decisions every day. There's evidence already that your body's pretty incredible, because there's so much else going on, and yet that's us trying to make up for just that small bit of a pancreas, like, just gives us this entire life's work.
Yeah.
So I've learned that to see it a different way. I haven't support why me, which I probably did in the beginning. I've seen it more as, okay, that's pretty amazing. Anything can be possible. If that's possible, then what else can be possible? And I had that kind of spring in my step almost about it. And then in doing that challenge, after the first week, I was in absolute bits. I was, you know, I was limping over finish lines. I was thinking I got on 3 weeks without a rest day to get to Land's End. And even then, like, I just had this hope, this belief that, you know, that there'll be a way. And the body adjusted. The body actually, you know, come the second week, was recovering much sharper than it was in the first week. It was like it got used to that was how my normal was for that period of time.
It wasn't shock, as big a shock. Talk a little bit about the support you had, because I've heard this story before, like, and I think it's lovely, like, but the support you had on route as well.
And that's what changed everything, really, is exactly that. It's people realizing in the community, you know, that you have with diabetes chat as well, you know, it's that community that makes you encouraged to perhaps go and present and then interview each week, which is a lot of effort that you two make, right? But it's because the people come along.
It's not just me. It's not. I'm barely here. Like Tom.
Exactly. And you know, but it's because that you realize that connection with people. And that's perhaps what I realized was, you know, in a different way, but I was running marathons, but it wouldn't have meant anything but for the people that were coming out. And whether it was, you know, there was this 5-year-old girl called Angel at the time, scary because she's probably now or whatever, you know, probably in her 20s. So but yeah, I was seeing those kids get something from it in a different way. They were starting to be not just inspired, but they saw diabetes different. They saw that diabetes and that's negative, this clinical thing that's invaded their lives. They saw it differently, that they could work with this, they could achieve the things if they worked.
It's a different message.
Yeah. And that's what really encouraged me that I needed to keep on running. And and I think that's what led to more things further down the line.
I know, and it's just conversations as you're moving down the country and you know, and somebody says something, you should do that, and then you've plenty of time to think about it on the run and going, yeah, and I could do that and I could do this and
what it did encourage me was that diabetes, I mean, it's, you know, you can take in so much from a consultation. You can take in so much from being in a hospital. You can take in so much even online and stuff now. But I think there's a real buzz from meeting others. I think that was what I saw in diabetes, but in this social atmosphere, actually helped education. And, you know, I wasn't given education, of course, as I was running. I was just talking and meeting people. But I saw that particularly the young people, the children, were responding well. And I look back to myself, and I never responded well to anything to do with diabetes. Mum said, go to this event. I'll be like, no, I don't want to go to that event. I'll start having a little tantrum. And so that's what really gave the idea to say, let's make the diabetes talk connect a little bit. Let's make it a bit more fun.
Is this what I love about what you do?
That's where it comes from.
Yeah. And it's like, it is just so powerful. Like the way you come down, that's wrong words. The way you can communicate so well with an age group that doesn't know how to communicate itself as well.
Probably mentally, I'm still on the same page, you know, same wavelength as the children that we work with sometimes. So I don't have any trouble there getting down to that level. But I know what you mean. It's like kind of trying to relate.
Yeah, it's relating and it's feeling.
Like, I think we can all do.
Yeah. Like it just. I think everybody who tries to help, like those that are younger and in transition, like you're trying to structure things and trying to get them where they're at and trying to get, but you want them to talk about diabetes, but you don't want to talk about diabetes because they don't want to talk about diabetes.
Yeah.
But you can get them to talk about their feelings.
Yeah. I think they help each other by being in a different environment. And then it just takes that wave of, okay, like we designed workshops. And, you know, the guys at Diafleet now, you know, Pal is a trustee. There's also Simran and Tracy and some volunteers. And, you know, and there's other people that have got other organizations around the world that are doing a similar thing.
And the League of Diathletes, I guess.
Yeah, in the network. So, but yeah, really, I mean, we can all do it because we all got the experience firsthand living with type 1 diabetes. And it's about trying to overcome ourselves first, you know, and then it's a case of what can we give to somebody else? What can we give to the next generation that lifts their spirits a little bit? You know, gives them, doesn't paint over the cracks, lets them know what they need to know. But at the end of it, what's the message? And if it's going to lift them up a little bit, then, and I think we've all got that to offer, even if we've had the worst experiences, help us give the best ones, the best advice to the next generation. And so, yeah, that's what we've kind of been about. And we designed workshops in a way to be that way, to get people feeling comfortable first and foremost, but then they see others saying simple things like, my favorite hypo treat is a jelly baby, what's yours? And you think, oh yeah, mine's also a jelly baby, or no, I disagree, I've got, you know, I'm a dextro or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you know, you see more people saying the same things, and that starts to make you feel comfortable to be there. And that's as simple as that's kind of worked over the years for many years now.
And from those early marathons and all that, but it all, I'm just thinking this, that came from your own confidence in yourself to prove to yourself that you can do what you're not supposed, what somebody's telling you shouldn't do, or that like is difficult, or but you're not just doing it, you're doing it very difficultly as well. And like, is it empowering people to have the confidence in themselves, like, and seeing that in humans, like that's spreading through Diathlete. Like, is there anything like about? I'm just thinking before we start talking about the charity and all, like how it's blossomed, like from where it started. Like, is there anything in particular that you could say that, I don't know, would inspire others from your beginning, like just from that little beginning?
Yeah. You know, it's not like, because quite often if you hear someone, some idiot tried to run 30 marathons in a month or whatever, 25 marathons in a month, all these stupid things, then it's not relatable, to be honest. But I think to begin with, when I did 30-30, I had a pint of beer every night just to check in there. I'm no professional athlete. Carol's shaking her head next to me because she's a dietitian. I got better results when I did 25 in a month, not just because I had 5 days off resting, but because I listened to the dietitian, who happens to be Paul.
Where was Paul involved in your marathons then?
So yeah, I came back and did fundraising it again, but for a different purpose, global purposes now. In 2018, 5 years after doing the 30-30 in 2013, and this time I had already met Pau. I met Pau in 2015, and so I knew of her as a dietitian, and actually had the association in Costa Rica, and I knew that she was probably the best about, and I might have liked her a little bit, so I asked her to be the dietitian for this challenge, and she came into it there. I can tell you, knowing what I know from my own body, that's like opening door one. It's reflecting on what you know from yourself, how your body responds to things, etc. That's valuable information. And then sharing that is phase two, sharing that with the people that can help it grow a little bit or give you that information around it. And I think we even obviously talk about tech and stuff, there's even more capabilities through what we've got now in terms of data. But giving that to Pal, she then gave me the advice from her knowledge, and I think we only had 3 hypo occurrences in the month for 25 minutes, which I'd have 3 hypos in a day most days probably before that. So that was pretty good going. But and the reason for that is more so, one, yeah, great job by Pau as well, but use of CGM, very helpful. But adding to that was, when you're doing something like I was doing, with the passion to do it, I was looking at my blood sugars all the time. I was really focused on it. Exactly. When I'm at home and I'm at work or whatever, probably less focused, you know? So that's why I'm off the ball that little bit. And that's when the highs and lows happen a little bit more frequently.
Makes sense.
I in some ways had a weird, obviously it's a crazy experience to try and battle the lows when you're running, but I was so concentrated every day and I had a helping hand, of course, to help concentrate with me that we actually only had 3 hypos in a month, which could have all been averted as well, if I'm honest, because they happened at the end of the marathon. And I knew at the end of the marathon, once I stopped running, I actually spiked high every day. So we didn't want to treat the low when it was going to add to the high. So they all happened the same way. So yeah, unfortunately, I'd have been so happy if I'd have done the whole thing without a low. Imagine.
You'd have to do it again.
That'd been on my gravestone at the end of my life. You know, I'd have been like, did that without a low.
You know, would you do it again?
No. I wouldn't I don't have the need to do, you know, anything that level of extreme anymore.
Well, that sounds terrible.
I don't have the need in terms of, like, you know.
Oh no, that's okay. Sorry, I thought you said knees.
Knees. I just about have the knees, but you never know. But yeah, I mean, it has been a while since I've done it. I don't know if I have the knees anymore, but I was even crossing the finish line and I wasn't feeling like I needed to punch the air and cry. When I first started, that's exactly what I was doing. I was punching the air and I was crying. You know, I was holding back tears of passion and joy. And it got to a point, I mean, I've actually done over 100 endurance challenges that are all pretty wacky. So, you know, you get to a point where, you know, that I guess like
that's normal
there anymore as such, you know. It's more I've done that, I've gone the distance, and I don't need to prove that to myself either to do that. I do have my eye sometimes on the River Thames, but I like to do things that are more involving people. I think that's the biggest joy I get, is when people, you know, type ones come together, when there's, you know, we did a challenge a few years ago as well, we had like a few people go over to Costa Rica and do a trek in the rainforest, and that was, you know, crazy, but it was like a different challenge, but it was beautiful because it was shared with people from different countries as well who live with type 1 diabetes, and yet through type 1 diabetes they're so different in every way, but so much in common, and that provides a memory that lasts the rest of your life in such a happy way. So that's where I get more enjoyment if I did a challenge. But I think I'm over that whole you know, do something mad. Never say never, but getting a bit of a look, but
No, that's brilliant. Thank you for that. Like, so we're gonna move on and then and talk about Diathlete. Tom, do you want to join on this one too? Are you off having a cup of tea?
No, I'm listening in and really interesting. And I know Leah is tuned in and she's training for the marathon for next year. So, Leah, if you have any questions, like, you've got two amazing people here, Gavin and Paula. So connect up and check out all their inspiring stories. And if you have any questions, then hook up with the guys later on. Really, really good. Yeah, I can definitely help with this. So to finish our night, we want to talk about Diathlete. And so can you guys share with us what is Diathlete? Sort of how was the sort of organization, charity set up? Why was it set up? When was it set up? Who's sort of part of the team? Is it other people, a mixture between people who have type 1 or connections? Like, just gives a little information about the amazing charity that you guys are a part of.
Yeah. So, it's a bit of a complex one if I try and spell it out loud. But so yeah, there's two names, if you like. There's Diathlete and there's League of Diabetes. We recently put the League of Diabetes part in there,
yeah,
because not everything that we do is actually sports related, and I think that doesn't relate to the key areas like the diabetes camp and things like that. And really there's two sides that we noticed, and one is really the well-being side,
mm-hmm.
The other is perhaps more not just sports advice, but also for the younger ones, the children. This is where Diathlete comes into it. Is we created workshops, we team with NHS teams to put these workshops on for their pediatric patients, and they use sporty games as a way to break down diabetes information or education. So it's like team insulin taking on team carbs in a game of tag rugby or whatever sport we might fancy trying to put in there. We've got understanding your diagnosis, team beta cells, and team immune system are going at it in a game of rounders. And so we kind of make it fun because they're enjoying the game, but then kind of bring the education into that fun. And that's always been a concept that I was initially doing by myself before we were a charity. Diathlete kind of started as my blog, and then I don't know, I just liked doing that. As I got to that running point where I thought that's where it needs to be, is education, can I help that? So I was always doing that as it's just a bit of fun on the side, really, just something that I was kind of passionate to do and creating these ideas. And so that, I had many years of doing it that way. I was working jobs on the side but never really able to actually work because that was quite busy. We decided, well, this is all charitable, so let's make it a charity. And in 2019 we shaped it that way. And that means we got some trustees on board, which is Pow, she's a trustee. There's Tracy Power, who actually she doesn't have diabetes at this moment because she has Addison's disease, and she got to a point of complications where she had to have a pancreatic transplant, which, so quite extreme cases. So, you know, fair play to her because she's been through so much with it and still goes through so much with it to an extent, and yet still in her own time every now and then. She's not always 100% there because, you know, she needs to take her own time to herself, but she does bring her skills, and she does still have that want to give back to the diabetes community, and so she's a trustee for that reason. They've all got like individual projects that they help out on. So Pal just led the diabetes camp. I'll have her share about that in a sec. Tracy helps with there's a documentary that we've been putting together, and that's really her area of work, about type 1 diabetes around the world. And Simran is a trustee who she's the youngest member of that team, and she's obviously living type 1. She's in uni at the moment, but has since a young age, really. She was one of the people that initially came to a workshop, and I see a future in her. I see a positive impact in her because she started getting involved with the charity. She started to give talks and things like that, and so she helps out with a lot of the workshops. That's great. Social media.
That's amazing.
Yeah, there's a bit of a team there, and always open to volunteers as well if people want to get involved, because it's just a small group of volunteers that run it.
So tell us then about the amazing things you've touched upon it briefly, but tell us some of the things that you are doing. So let's bring Paula back in. So the event, the diabetes camp that you did over the summer, tell us a little bit about that, like the idea of what it is. And is I think, did you do it pre-lockdown, was it? And then obviously this is the first one back since the whole lockdown and stuff, like, and sort of what did you do at the camp, and tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, of course. So well, it came because I've been doing camps in Costa Rica for the last maybe 7 or 8 years, but for children and adolescents. And in Latin America and the US, the camps are like super famous. There are always camps going on for children and for adults. And we thought, oh, there's nothing like that here in the UK for adults specifically. Yes. So we said, well, now there's a lot of like support online, but we feel like we need something face to face.
So
the camp, it was in Aldershot. We had around 37 people. We had volunteers, all with type 1, healthcare professionals, all with type 1 except one. we did a mix of outdoor activities such as kayaking, archery, climbing. We did educational sessions, but like interactive. So they weren't like with like indoors, they were more outdoors. And some social bits. We did campfire where everyone were sharing about their stories. So yeah, that was with the camps, and I think it was really good.
I think it's absolutely incredible. I think things like this is fantastic, and like you say, it's something that we don't really see in the UK much, especially for adults. And I know there's several things in like America and other things, other countries, that they have similar things to children and adults. And I love the concept of going to camp and hanging out with your sort of diet buddy, just like you say, sitting around that campfire and having a moment to tell people your story and hear stories and resonate and go, you know what, that's me, I'm wearing that t-shirt, I've been in that position, and having that friend who you can connect with and get advice. And but also what I like from what you're saying is you're learning stuff as well, but also you're just hanging out with people, just normal people, who of course live with diabetes, but going out and doing your kayaking and things like that, it just normalizes things. And I think peer support is so good and has so many benefits, and online peer support is good, and but I think if you got the opportunity to connect with people offline, it does have huge impacts, I think, for, like you say, the well-being and mental health. And I just think it's fantastic. And is it something that you will continue to hopefully do like into next year? Will there be several programs, or you'll see once you've had a breather after October, you'll go forward? Because I think it just sounds great, and I think the more of things, the more you guys can do this, it just sounds fantastic to me.
Yeah, we want to do it like an annual thing and possibly expand to Ireland, because there's like a huge
there you go, there, Mary.
Ireland's very, very good.
Yeah, so we got three girls from Ireland this time. That shows that there's like a lot of people that want to volunteer in Ireland too. So we would like to do both, but it's also hard because a lot of the places where you would usually do camps or residentials, they just accept children. So it's really hard to find a place. So we'll see, but we hope this would be our annual main event.
Yeah. No,
sounds great. It really does.
What about scouting places?
Those are the ones that just allow children.
Yeah, they changed the
rules. Yeah, they've been changing the rules ultimately, but yeah, we need to find out for next year. If you have ideas, feel free to reach out.
Yeah, I'll imagine.
I'll ask about. I'm a scouter as well, you see. So
nice.
Go ahead.
I'll ask.
Cool, thank you.
And I think the interesting thing, did you find that there were just so many, like say, over 30 people just from different backgrounds and given different perspectives. And I guess it's just nice, isn't it, to just be amongst that group and hearing their stories, right? And just resonating and connecting. And I guess that's the power of peer support and the benefits of that bring positive, hopefully, mental health, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that was a big focus of the camp, wasn't it? It was really looking at the psychological well-being, the mental health side of diabetes. Yeah. And
it's not like a focus of exercise and pure exercise and that sort of stuff. It's the, like you said, the mental health and well-being. And I think that's so, so important, isn't it? So, so vital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it needs to be for adults as well. Like I see it in our house. Like your diabetes doesn't change as soon as you hit 18. Like you still, like you just get more responsibilities on your shoulders, and you have to look after your own health. And we
talked about that offline, didn't we, Mary, before tonight's chat? And you know what I mean? Our lives are so busy and hectic with work and like other commitments and families and life and everything and diabetes. But having these amazing opportunities to go to camp and have a good time and meet others and socialize and learn things and in a fun way and hear people's stories and share stories. I think it's special because there's not enough time in a day, is there, for moments like this. So huge, like amazing for like all you're doing for that. Well done, well done. Mary, do you want to run with the next question about what's coming up? Excited, well, right?
Like this, I get to ask the exciting one, don't I? Like about the festival.
Yeah.
Just having a side chat here, guys. So I remember when I think Gavin, I've seen you twice this year. I've seen you with Simran and when Paolo, you were over, was it with your sister as well, Paolo? Is that right?
Yeah, true.
And I remember when Simran was talking about the festival, and I just remember, like, we're literally talking about camps and stuff for adults and all. And when you started talking about the idea of the festival, like, it just put goosebumps on my knees. It's like, it's fun, it's stuff people go to, but it's young as well. Like, it's full of life. Like, tell us about the festival, tell us where it is, tell us everything.
Yeah, so it's happening in Greenwich on the 14th of October. It is exciting. I mean, it's something a bit different, and I think this is similar to the adult camp. You know, it's a camp, but it's for adults. It's one of those things where I think there's a need, and it's something that you have to step out your comfort zone almost to go to, because it's not online. It's not, you know, you have to throw yourself in the deep end almost. And I guess for us, like, as a team, or when we're organizing it, you know, when Pal and Sim and, you know, are trying to make these things happen, there's an anxiety, because are people going to come? Are people going to, you know, putting in that time, the effort, trying to make it happen, plan, organize, etc. And yeah, you just don't know if it's going to happen or how it's going to go, which takes a lot of work in the background, which particularly, you know, Pal, Sim, Trace, they don't get the credit perhaps that they deserve for that effort they do without ever taking any credit for it.
Yeah, there's a lot involved.
There's so much, and I think even more with this festival is it's a personal one as well, because it's a fundraiser, and that's the reason behind it. That's the reason for doing it, and all, I think that's part of, like, when I was doing the fundraisers for running marathons, is I don't mind not making the finish line. I do mind if I haven't quite achieved what I set out to achieve and raise the awareness and the funds for what I'm trying to help and support. And so in this case, the T1D Festival is supporting, four charities overall, because obviously we're one, but more importantly, there's work going on. We have a network that we kind of chair, if you like. It's a volunteer, you know, open network, but these organizations are all quite similar. They're not perhaps your national associations. They're more grassroots and more local, around 20 odd countries in the world. in that. We're trying to support three of those guys based in, well, there's the Sonya Nabeta Foundation. I'll start with those. They are primarily active in Uganda, but they also do work that is, and it's really needed. It's going right across Africa, I would say, more and more. Reaching Ghana, where I've been a number of times, and I think the impact that Sonya Nabeta Foundation are having in Ghana, for example, I've seen in 2015. I mean, there's a lot of people I met in 2015 that are no longer alive today, and they're the same age as me or younger. Yeah. And you know, have the same condition as me, and it's a very different world. And SNF have managed to open since 2021 with Sanford Health's clinic centers. They've opened 5 diabetes specific centers. Now that might not sound like much, but that is significant, because actually when COVID first started and Nana Emma Barnes left the country, who was a main doctor that founded a local support group called Diabetes Youth Care, she's still active over there, but she lives in the United States. There's just one qualified pediatric diabetologist, one person qualified in diabetes, really, who studied it, active in the country at that time. So to now have since then 5 centers that specify in diabetes care opening up because of SNF, because of their work, because of their influence, that shows what a positive change can happen from the inside. And that's the point, and that's the awareness, at least. We're probably not going to raise that much funds that can help, and you need long-term funds that continue to come in order to bring about changes. So we're not going to help that, but what we want to help is at least getting people aware about the growing gaps. When we're talking about technology and stuff, which is a great benefit for us, there's people that there's no quote unquote market for it. Even though there is a market, there's people living with type 1 diabetes in these countries, but the health system isn't there. They don't have an NHS. And so,
they didn't even have electricity fully through the day.
Cut out and stuff. I saw Hamida actually was tuning in, and she's probably tuned out and in and out a few times because of the connection.
Yeah.
And she's based in Uganda. So, I mean, I've seen firsthand that.
Like you said, it's a completely different world. And Paula mentioned before, isn't it? Like, we talked about your journey and when you were diagnosed and talked about syringes and stuff. And it's remarkable that we're in 2023 and there's still a lot of countries and people out there who are still using these sort of things, isn't it? And it's a completely different world, and it makes us ever so more grateful for the NHS and the people who are listening in the UK, isn't it? It's so honestly, thank you for having this event and having these amazing charities and raising that awareness, and hopefully people can help and support, and it will hopefully help people out there, isn't it? Like you say, people of all ages, but
what we got is perhaps a unique thing about it as well, is we are trying, and we have got a good bit of support from DDoc. Yep. Help us to get a few over to share firsthand their experiences. I'm having a bit of an issue with the UK border visas, there's been a few turned down to date, and I'm trying to change that. But we do have a good number of people from around the world coming, not just people from these countries that are doing where the charities are being raised, but actually in our network as well, from different countries, from Latin America, from Europe, Bulgaria, for example. It's all different stories. So we're going to hear about that firsthand at the festival. And we've got 2 things to the festival as well. So for us, the diabetes community, it starts at 1:00. You can book your tickets now. It's all available on the League of Diabetes website. Probably been tweeting it quite a bit. So I'll look on the social channels. You'll probably find links there. But yeah, from 1 till 3:30, we've got panel sessions. One is on diabetes and tech and that adjustment that we were talking about earlier, with some experiences there. We've got John Pemberton coming. So you probably know him. So yeah, he's pretty cool. So that's one of the names. We've got then a session on everyday in motivation with some panelists there. And then we've got the global awareness bit. So that's the kind of pre bit, if you like, for the diabetes community to attend to if you want. That is the ticket prices. Every ticket is a donation, but that is included with the ticket. And then from 5:00, the doors open for you know, a fun evening, hopefully. We've got live music coming on, making it more of a festival thing. This is the unknown for us, but we're making it more of a festival thing with DJs and some guys willing to play. We've announced two acts so far, I believe. So Emma Langford is an award-winning Irish singer and songwriter, folk singer songwriter. Her sister Jean has type 1, but yeah, she's been really popular over there, so she's coming over. She does give a bit of energy, positive energy to her performances. She gets everybody involved, so that's one of our actors.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, I know Jean. That's great.
I know Jean as well.
Is Jean coming over as well?
Yeah, Jean will be there. Yeah, she's actually co-organizing the event with us, so
great stuff.
Yeah, Jean will be there, and she's actually going to be a panelist, so we'll hear from Jean about her experiences. We've got a DJ, Sophia. Well, she goes by the stage name is Sophia Violet, and she's part of a really up and coming group. She's all over the place at the moment called Girls Don't Sink, and so Sophia, as a DJ, she's young. She's I think maybe just out of uni, really popular. Getting events. She was doing Boomtown Festival recently with in front of thousands of people. So there's some good videos you can see on her profile. And she's a type 1 as well, so she's going to be there. We'll interview them, we'll then have them perform. There's two more that I think are all but confirmed, but I can't reveal them just yet because I've not quite seen. So we should have some acts, and whilst that's happening, we're looking to do like a fundraising auction and things like that on the night. And raise awareness, interview all the people from overseas as well.
Diane says, got my tickets, smiley face. Leah says, how can I get involved? So like Gav said, head over to leagueofdiabetes.org. Is that right? And you'll be able to see all the things that we've been talking about tonight, the charity and the camps and the festival, but also check out their Twitter handle and stuff. And you'll be able to see all that. I just think it's great. And really unique, and I like the whole two sides to it, the panelists and the sort of things before from like one, and then an evening of fun. And and you know what, when I go to events, I've done a few events this past year, and I love two sides of it, whether I'm presenting or whether I'm there in the audience watching and stuff. I think it's great, like learning these things and seeing people share their experiences and learn new things. But for me, what I really enjoy from these sort of events is like the after parties and things where you actually go to a pub or you go somewhere and you're just hanging out with normal people who happen to have type 1 or diabetes, different types of diabetes. And that's what you guys are doing. You've got them both perspectives where you'll have like sessions about learning, educating and things like that, and then the panelists, and then that fun side. And I just think it's great, and people should check it out. Saturday the 14th, right?
That's right, yeah. And if we spend over $2,000 in the bar, they give us the money for the venue back. So that's an extra one. So get to the bar as well.
Get to the bar. Brilliant. Honestly, Mary, I just think it's been such a insightful chat. We've talked for like pretty much an hour and a half. Really, really appreciate it. Your time tonight to come on and share every element to it. We start the night with our fun quick fire questions, getting to know you both. It's been really good having a perspective of husband and wife who have diabetes, and then we got to know you guys a little bit more with your journey and when you were diagnosed with diabetes, and like you said, talked about the tech and how things evolved. Also looking at growing up with diabetes in different parts of the world. I think that was really fascinating, wasn't it, Mary? And then going on to the great session with Mary, talking with Paula about your career as a diabetes dietitian. I think that's great, and all the amazing stuff that you're doing, and then a lot on about exercise. You know what I mean, we could have had like an hour and a half chat just on them elements. So I think we've touched upon little bits tonight, and then I think just to finish it, talking about Diathlete, I just want to ask one final question. What does mental health mean to you, and why is peer support important?
I think in my case, mental health, when I think about life and diabetes, I imagine myself like in the middle. I'm like very visual. And then around me, things need to be like on a similar level. So it's mental health, physical health, including food, physical activity, having people around. So for me, if mental health is not part of that thing that surrounds me, it would look a bit disorganized and it wouldn't, all the other things wouldn't work as well.
Yes.
So if mental health is not okay, it's harder to exercise, it's harder to eat well, it's harder to meet others. So I think it's like a very, very important part of our life. And sometimes it's underestimated. And we think that we really, really, really need a dietitian, but we don't need a psychologist, for example. And I think we're all like the same, in the same level of importance.
I mean, that's great. What about you, Gavin?
Yeah, I agree with what she, what Paola said there. I feel if you think about it, everything you do, us having a conversation now, is being generated from the brain. Mm. And so when we talk about health, we often jump to the conclusion, oh, we need to eat this, we need to be this active and stuff. But it really does, the center of all that is what's in your head to how you feel, how you're going to go about these things. So it begins there. And I think it is good in recent times that we're talking more about mental health when you consider, even more so with diabetes, we're making 180 faults. I saw, I think, a day on that. So there's a lot of mental well-being that's being burnt out in some ways through this condition alone. So we need to really focus on that as a prime part of our diabetes management.
And peer support is a hug that we don't know we need.
A hug we don't know we need.
Enough hugs at home. Writing that down.
Absolutely. Yeah. I get that. Like, totally do. And we should all have lots and lots of hugs on the 14th of October in the festival, right? There we go.
I'm just sharing a post. I was trying to find the link for the festival just to share. So I've just stuck a hashtag diabetes chat on a repost. Tom, if you want.
Yes, I'll retweet it out. Yeah, absolutely. But honestly, thank you so much, Gavin and Paola, for your time today. Incredible time. Thank you for everything that you're doing. And Gavin, I must finish. You've been nominated, haven't you? Please say you, like, it's not like brand new news to you, and this is, but you've been nominated for the Quality in Care Diabetes The People's Award 2023. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, I did see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyone who hasn't seen it, Gavin, fantastic, has been nominated for the 2023 Quality in Care Diabetes Award for someone who in the UK who's not a healthcare professional, who is a volunteer, a person with diabetes, someone who gives back to the community, does so many amazing things for the community. And I think you're truly, amazing, fantastic person, and deserve the recognition for that award. And I wish the best of luck for you on next month, isn't it? So fingers crossed for you and all the best, and truly, truly deserved for everything that you are doing, and great job.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah. I mean, the most important thing is we all... you know, I know there's other people getting nominated for awards as well. And I kind of feel like with things like that, you need to just give everybody the credit if you like. Yeah. And you know, we're all going through diabetes together. So I think that's what counts the most, is that things like Diabetes Chat are going on to support other people. And I think it's the more of those initiatives that get shared and people are aware about, then the better. Awards are nothing special, I think. It's nice to be recognised, of course, but yeah, it's doing what we can do, our little bit, each of us.
Yes, awareness of what we all kind of do as well. Like, we're all trying to just be trusted.
Yeah.
Those that trust, that see us, then we'll tell more people.
Mm. Yeah, true.
Yeah. I've loved tonight.
I really have. Thank you so much, guys. Keep looking out, guys, all amazing stuff like Gavin and Paul and the rest of the team are doing. Check out the Twitter and their website, and keep an eye on the festival upcoming and next year's camps and all the amazing stuff they're doing. But honestly, bar for Diabetes Chat, myself and Mary, it's been great tonight. Thank you, Gavin. Thank you, Paula.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
See you in October.
Bye. See you in October.
Right.
You're following #DiabetesChat.